Today on Against the Grain, Americans don't like to be taxed, we're told. After all, who would willingly part with their hard-earned money? But according to my guest, that assumption is largely incorrect. Vanessa Williamson has studied attitudes toward paying taxes and argues that our misperceptions have all sorts of deleterious consequences, including discounting the contributions of low-income people. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll also discuss the Republican tax bill, one of the least popular pieces of legislation in recent history. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Conventional wisdom holds that Americans hate to pay taxes, and hence, progressive reforms aren't viable because they wouldn't find funding. But scholar Vanessa Williamson says such conclusions aren't backed up by evidence. For Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes, Williamson examined national surveys of American attitudes to taxation and did her own extensive in-depth interviews. And her findings illuminate a great deal, including about class, race, and inequality. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and the co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Vanessa, why is the notion that Americans hate to pay taxes wrong?
Well, so yeah, as you say, there is a widely held misperception that Americans just hate taxes. You know, they're not willing to pay the bills. They don't understand what government uses the money for, and or they're just kind of, cowboys who like to do it on their own or something like this. It's just a myth. The reality is that Americans see taxpaying as a very important civic duty, and they're very proud to describe themselves as taxpayers. In fact, you can hear that in rhetoric on the right and the left. I heard it regularly when I was interviewing Tea Party activists. You know, they'd say things like, "I'm a taxpayer," and the end of that sentence was almost never about taxes. It was always about demonstrating a right to be heard. So we have this idea that Americans dislike taxes that I think comes from a kind of conservative rhetoric with its origin in the late 70s and early 80s that was sort of an anti-government rhetoric. But even 40 years on and throughout that entire period, if you ask Americans, is it their civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes? Overwhelming majorities say yes, numbers like 90 or 95%, which is a level of consensus you almost never see in America.
Well, I'll ask you in a moment about that tax revolt that you just mentioned, but this may come as news, what you're saying, to a lot of listeners who understand that a aversion to taxes drives politics, especially on the right. How do you separate the rhetoric, say, of the Republican Party from Americans who would presumably include people on the right?
So the important thing to remember is that our politics isn't driven by public opinion. And so you often find very high majorities of support in favor of things that neither party is currently supporting or neither party treats as their primary issue. And you can see that on gun control. Right? Huge majorities of Americans support various kinds of sensible gun legislation, but neither party wants to touch that. You see the same thing with raising the minimum wage, very high levels of support for a higher minimum wage, but it's only very recently become even a partial priority of the Democratic Party. So what actually drives parties is not what the sort of median voter thinks or what average people think about an issue. What drives them is motivated, active constituencies within the party system. And there are very motivated, very active constituencies within the Republican Party that are committed to lowering taxes, especially for the wealthy. There's no way you could miss that this week. And also sort of a longer commitment to a kind of anti-government backlash that stems in large part from a kind of backlash to the civil rights movement and to the extension of government benefits to blacks and other minorities.
Well, take us back to the 1978 tax revolt, which you say has shaped public perceptions of American attitudes around taxes. What happened at that time?
So it's a kind of a funny story in a way. In California, of course, there was Proposition 13, which capped property taxes. And, you know, the best sociological research suggests that in many ways that fight came out of a desire to to be protected against market forces, right? Because one reason property taxes were going up is because housing prices were shooting through the roof, right? So some homeowners who were not particularly wealthy were suddenly sitting on a house that was worth vastly more than they could afford in taxes, right? And so that anger, which was actually in some ways, from, you know, seeking a market protection, got translated in the Republican Party into a recognition that you could use relatively small critiques of the tax system to, as a kind of leverage, to create a much more frontal assault on what government was doing. And so that's, I think, what you see as the sort of origins of the Reagan Revolution.
So you're saying that even our perceptions of what drove it might be somewhat wrong.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what's interesting is some of the early activists who wanted to put in place a property tax cap for homeowners in California were also interested in rent control. We don't think of those issues as even remotely related now, right?
Indeed,
the
no.
Property tax, that's what the far right wants, and rent control, well, that's a progressive issue. Originally, those were actually issues that moved forward together because of the concern about housing and about people getting pushed out of their neighborhoods, right? But I think conservatives recognized that anger about a particular tax issue in a particular place could be harnessed to support a much broader reform, in part because tax policy is complicated. So you get anger about one issue, you get taxes back on the table, and then you can create policies that benefit a lot of special interests, sort of using that fervor, even though that wasn't what was driving them originally.
Have attitudes, with the caveats you've just mentioned, around taxes changed from then to now? How do we see if the tax revolt reverberates very strongly in people's minds when they think about taxes? How would you trace the changes in how people see taxes from the late 70s to now?
There have been really fundamental changes, actually. So the Republican Party really harnesses this energy and the sort of government backlash at the end of the 70s to promote a very strong anti-tax kind of rhetoric. But what you see over the following decades is a very striking increase in the rate at which state voters are voting to increase their own taxes. So if you put a measure on the ballot in the late 70s or early 80s to raise taxes, maybe one in five of those measures passed, right? Not great odds. Today, in the last 15 years, if you put a measure on the ballot at the state level to raise taxes, you got a 50-50 shot of that ballot measure passing. And I don't need to explain to listeners in California that that is a very successful rate of ballot measure passage, right? Because many of these measures fail very early on in the process, right? But now, about half the time, you're seeing voters vote to raise their own taxes. And it's all different kinds of taxes. Sales taxes get increased that way. Income taxes have been increased that way. A lot of different kinds of taxes have been successfully raised at the polls. So I think the question is really less, will voters actually vote for tax increases? It's clear that they will. But whether politicians have the sort of courage to actually put that question to the voters in their own platforms.
How should we then see the clamor of the Tea Party around 2010 in the trajectory you're painting?
So my book before, this most recent one on tax paying in America, was on the Tea Party. And so back in 2009, 10, and 11, I was very interested in this issue. And so I visited Tea Party events, not just the big rallies, but also meetings in Massachusetts and in Virginia and in Arizona, just to sort of get a handle on what this phenomenon was. And, it was a genuinely grassroots phenomenon in part, right? So there really were these groups meeting who were just relatively normal, older white conservatives who were interested in politics, but they weren't, they weren't second cousins of the Koch brothers or whatever the sort of rumors about that kind of stuff were. They were, normal American voters. And they were very angry about what they thought the government was doing. They were very frightened by the presidency of Barack Obama, both his policies, but also the sort of person of Barack Obama and what he represented. And one of the most striking things we found in our research was that a very deeply motivating issue was this sense of cultural change, that the country had changed, that it was not the country they had grown up in, and that Barack Obama represented this change. And that was partially, of course, a sense that Barack Obama was not an American citizen, right? And so he came to sort of represent an influx of foreigners, right? And so this terrible birther myth, which some Tea Party activists I told you really did believe wholeheartedly, and others found sort of symbolically resonant, even if they didn't actually believe it. For people in the Tea Party, Barack Obama represented the changing demographics of the country and sort of tapped into their fears about immigration. And they were very frightened of a country, not that provided large social services, right? That was what people tried to say they were talking about. But, you know, many of these people were beneficiaries of Medicare and Social Security, and they liked those programs. But they liked them for people they saw as deserving, people they saw as having chipped in. And they didn't see younger generations, and they didn't, frankly, see racial minorities and immigrants as having paid in their fair share. So they were very angry about that. And I think we actually saw the continuation of that in the Trump primary, where the first, he really was the first Republican candidate who was willing to be as extreme as the Republican primary voters wanted to be on immigration. And so he really tapped into that fervor.
You mentioned that the Tea Party activists were white. Can you make generalizations about their class background?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, like most older white people, they, you know, older white people are doing a little better on average than the rest of the country. They've, you know, often been able to buy a home, that kind of thing. So they were mostly solidly middle-class people. They, you know, tended to be retirees, the sort of people who have both the resources in terms of time to contribute to volunteer activities, including the Tea Party, but also people who had something of a civic background. So, you know, they'd been involved in the PTA, or they were involved in their church, or they were involved in the school board, or the library council, or what have you. So they tended to people with, you know, sort of a solidly middle-class background, people with a little bit of civic experience, and people with a sort of time and resources that being able to retire offers.
Vanessa Williamson is my guest. She's the author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Could you give us a sort of potted history of taxation in the U.S.? I want to ask you a lot more about the class background, racial background, the attitudes of different segments of American society toward taxes. Just to situate us in this moment, obviously there's more than one kind of tax, which often gets forgotten. Republicans in particular seem to be very focused on the income tax. People pay different kinds of taxes. But can you make some generalizations about the arc of a number of these crucial taxes over the last, say, century? Where do we stand in historical terms?
That's a great question. So yeah, so first of all, it's important to remember that Americans pay a lot of different kinds of taxes. Most Americans, the federal income tax is not the most expensive tax that they pay. So you need to remember that we're paying sales taxes, we're paying payroll taxes that support Social Security and Medicare, we're paying income taxes at the federal and the state level, and then there's excise taxes like taxes on gasoline, on cigarettes, on alcohol. So people are paying a lot of different kinds of taxes. Overall, the American system is progressive, at least until you get to the really very rich, right? But for most of the income spectrum, the tax system is progressive. And
progressive meaning that it increases the wealthier you are up until that level of the super rich.
Exactly, yes. And so you have to bear in mind that, you know, once you're talking about people making, I don't know, $60 million a year, right? It's actually very hard to know how much money they even make. There's often money made internationally. I mean, so it's actually quite hard to estimate the taxes of people who are in the, you know, 0.001% or something like that. But from the sort of spectrum of sort of, you know, from the lowest income people up to, you know, very well-paid lawyers, let's say, or very well-paid doctors, the tax system is progressive, right? And it's actually, it's relatively easy to keep in mind, right? If you take account of all the taxes people pay, the poorest 20% of Americans pay about a fifth of their income in taxes, and the richest 20% of Americans pay about a third of their income in taxes, and it goes up like a little slope upward between those two categories. But then at the very, very top, you see it level off, and it's likely that at the very, very, very top, it starts to go back down again. Historically speaking, we've had a federal income tax, the modern federal income tax, for just over 100 years now. It was originally a tax aimed exclusively at the very rich. It was a class tax. It only becomes a tax that's paid by middle-income people in order to pay for World War II. So that's the first time, you know, they actually had little patriotic cartoons with like Donald Duck and other characters to explain to people that for the first time you're going to have to save money so that you can pay this income tax that's going to come due, you know. So that's the first time you see the income tax become a mass tax. For the time that we've had an income tax, we've also had a corporate tax, a tax on corporations and their profits. That tax has sort of steadily declined in terms of the amount of revenue it brings in from its institution, more or less, until today. And then finally, I should say that there is an estate tax at the federal level, which is a tax that people who die with estates in the $5, $10 million range or more start to have to pay on income, on the estate value over those amounts. And that is actually, it's not a huge revenue raiser, but it is one of the most important policy tools we have to encourage progressivity and to sort of prevent, to the extent possible, sort of an economic aristocracy from developing over multiple generations. Before we had an income tax, we actually had a system of tariffs. And so that was, you know, if you look all throughout the 19th century, you'll see the huge fights about, between manufacturers and farmers about what the tariffs should be. One of the funny things about that period is often the tariffs were in place often to protect industries, and the government often didn't actually have a clear plan of what they should do with all of that money. So it's kind of the opposite situation from what we have now, where, it's sort of hard to imagine being in a situation where the government has too much money and doesn't know how to spend it. But yeah, so that's a sort of short history of sort of modern taxation.
And how does the United States compare in terms of taxation to Canada and Europe, to equivalent advanced industrial countries?
So that's a great question. You will be perhaps surprised to know that our tax system is actually somewhat more progressive than many of the countries you think of as progressive countries, because we rely heavily on an income tax, while other countries rely heavily on a VAT, which is sort of like a sales tax, more or less. And sales taxes are regressive, right? Because as a general rule, lower income people have to spend more of their money. They don't have very much money to spend, and you have to buy a certain amount of food and housing and clothes and all these things. So sales taxes tend to be more expensive for poorer people. So in countries that rely more heavily on things like a VAT, their tax systems are more regressive, where they're more progressive in how they spend the money. So that may become as a bit of a surprise. The thing that more people, I think, are familiar with is the fact that we're a relatively low tax country. So our system is progressive, but the overall amount of revenue we raise compared to our GDP is relatively low, while other countries raise far more money with their tax system and spend far more money because they do things like provide health insurance to their entire population, strong retirement protections, and things like that.
In the United States, how would you compare the tax on the wealthy? Now, as you say, tax for the non-wealthy didn't come in until World War II, but just in terms of percentages, how would you compare taxes for the wealthy in the New Deal period to where we are now?
So the income tax at its sort of high point had a top marginal tax rate of over 90%. Today, the top marginal rate is 39-ish percent, and of course, it is currently somewhat in flux because we're looking at new tax legislation here in D.C. just this week. And I should be clear about what a marginal tax rate is. It doesn't mean that rich people paid 90% of their overall income. It means that the money they earn that's in that top bracket, whatever the top bracket was, is taxed at 90%. Right. So everyone pays the lowest rate on their bottom $10,000 of earnings, and everyone pays the second rate on the money they make that's in that next bracket. Right. So sometimes people misunderstand what marginal rates are. Nonetheless, the top marginal rates for the wealthy have steadily declined in the second half of the 20th century and only increased very slightly in the 21st century when the Bush tax cuts expired.
And what has driven down those rates?
There's been a pretty steady trend that when we do tax reform, the top rates somehow go down again. You know, and often, you know, there's tax reforms that should and, you know, need to happen. But somehow in that process of making taxes either simpler or more sensible, somehow we always seem to bring down or almost always seem to bring down that top rate. And what that means is that there's basically a very large incentive right now to make a lot of money. While if you have a very high marginal rate on that top level of income, there's less of an incentive to go from making $1 million to making $2 million a year, or going from make $2 million a year to $5 million a year, because a larger percent of that money would be recouped by the government, right? So what we've done is create a system that really does incentivize people who are very wealthy to maximize their income in ways that really wasn't incentivized in previous generations.
And how would you place the ideas on offer right now in the context of what you've just described?
You mean, how would I describe the tax plan that's currently moving through Congress?
Yes.
The current plan is a disaster on so many levels that it is genuinely hard for me to know where to begin. It is a plan that is clearly committed not just to increasing the income and wealth of the wealthy, but particularly to increasing the wealth of people who earn money by having money, as opposed to people who earn money by having a job. And so the impact of that and the impact of things like removing the AMT, the impact of taking away the estate tax, will be, it's quite clear, economically speaking, to enrich people who have already been pulling away from the rest of America at the expense of almost literally everyone else. And when I say at the expense of almost everyone else, on first of all, of course, because there are provisions in the current versions of the bill that will actually raise taxes for many middle-income people, and especially if you look in the longer term, because they have some short-term tax cuts to kind of fudge the numbers that will expire, right? So if you look 10 years out, a lot of individuals can expect to see a tax increase under this plan, while, of course, lowering the corporate tax rate tremendously and lowering the taxes on income that comes from investments by really very substantial rates. So, the effect of this will really be to reinforce what is already, I think, a very troubling level of economic inequality. And I should emphasize that it will also likely increase the racial wealth gap in really significant ways. And that's a story I think that gets underreported a little bit. But the fact is that because of systematic discrimination, there's an income gap between Black Americans and white Americans. Then that's a large gap. But there's an even larger wealth gap.
The assets, not just the incomes of these two groups.
Exactly. Right. So, and that comes from the fact that there have been for generations systematic policies that made it extremely hard for African Americans to accrue wealth in terms of the kind of housing that, because, you know, for Americans, much of their, you know, for normal Americans who are not super wealthy, much of their wealth is in their house. Policies that made it hard for African Americans to buy houses in many neighborhoods, made it impossible for them to buy in many neighborhoods. And, you know, the sort of compounding effect of generations of that discrimination has led to an enormous gap in the assets of white Americans and Black Americans. And so policies that today increase the wealth of the wealthy also increase the racial wealth gap in really significant and, I think, very troubling ways.
Well, let's talk about race, because that is a central component of the research you have done about American attitudes towards taxation. Can you tell us the role that race plays? Let's just start first with white Americans and how they see taxes.
That's a great question. So actually, I'm going to start a little further back, if that's okay, sort
sure.
of historically. You asked me some historical questions, and so now I'm thinking of things in those terms. So Americans have basically always seen taxpaying as evidence that one should have representation in government. So obviously going back to the taxation without representation arguments at the very beginning of the founding of our country, the suffragists, the women's movement, argued that women should have the right to vote because women owned property and paid taxes, and therefore they had every right to be involved in the government that decided how to spend that money. African Americans, you know, there's an extraordinary story. In Miami in the late 50s, African American activists decided to integrate the beaches, which were then segregated, and they brought with them to the shore their property tax receipts as a way of demonstrating that they'd paid for the beaches and had every right to be there. And I think you see the same kind of rhetoric today when you look at undocumented residents in America who have, you know, on many occasions argued that they should have a pathway to citizenship because they pay taxes, right? So there was a campaign called Viva Taxes for a few years, sort of demonstrating that undocumented people were chipping in and therefore deserve the rights of citizenship. So this is a very strong rhetoric in America. And what's interesting is you actually see it on both sides, right? So when you look at people who oppose a pathway to citizenship for undocumented people, they will say that undocumented people don't pay taxes. Undocumented people certainly do pay taxes, and I can talk you through the numbers of that. I mean, obviously, they pay sales taxes and payroll taxes and all those sorts of taxes that come kind of automatically, but and they pay payroll taxes without being able to benefit from Social Security. But they also pay income taxes through the use of a special set of numbers that replaces as Social Security numbers. So undocumented people actually pay a lot in taxes. And but what's interesting is that when anti-immigration activists taunt, they don't say, yes, those people pay taxes, but no, I don't think they should be citizens, right? Which is an argument one could make. They often frame it, and you know, Donald Trump has regularly framed it, in terms of undocumented people not paying taxes, and therefore they don't deserve citizenship, right? So there's a very strong rhetoric in America. And you know, as I think that history sort of demonstrates, the debate about who counts as a taxpayer has often sort of recapitulated ethnic and racial boundaries and boundaries of who we consider full citizens. And so I think, you know, if you go up into the 1980s, let's say, the rhetoric you used to hear about welfare queens, right, was almost always in opposition to a rhetoric about taxpayers, right? So there was the stereotype of the person who would be cheating the government out of benefits, and the poor, unfortunate taxpayer who was, you know, playing by the rules and paying for this person's lavish lifestyle. That was almost always the rhetoric you would hear. It was the rhetoric President Reagan would use.
So a taxpayer, in a way, becomes a stand-in for a hardworking white American.
Taxpayer becomes a stand-in for a hardworking American with the limits on that community that whoever said it has put. Right. So, yeah, sometimes it's in the sort of welfare rhetoric. It was sort of taxpayer is a category that's sort of racialized as white, while welfare recipient is a category that's racialized as black. Right. But you see it, you know, but you see it in the women's movement, too. Right. That people use their standing as taxpayers to try and move those boundaries, right? So it's a fight on both sides, where both sides, whether you are trying to be more create a more inclusive society or maintain exclusion and hierarchy, both sides use this rhetoric of the taxpayer to make their argument.
That's the voice of Vanessa Williamson. We'll return with her in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with the author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. That's published by Princeton University Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And its author is Vanessa Williamson. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. So you've been arguing then that people have tried to claim the mantle of taxpayer to legitimize their perspective on one side or the other over issues that can be highly charged, like immigration and so on. I wonder if you could talk about something that you are alluding to, which is that there is a group of people who tend to be invisible in terms of their tax payment, the undocumented being the most acute example of that. But broadly speaking, that low-income people seem to disappear off the map when discussing taxes and taxpayers and who has the right to make political claims. Why should we think differently about how low-income people pay taxes?
That's a great question. So a thing that I found in my surveys and my interviews is that there's a tendency in America to underestimate the taxes paid by lower-income people, in part because the taxes lower-income people pay are pretty easy to pay. Right, the sales tax happens automatically. You don't have to think about it. Payroll taxes are deducted automatically. You don't really have to think about them. While the federal income tax is an enormous pain in terms of paperwork, and you are obliged to think about it. Right. So there's sort of a differential of hassle. Right. So you tend to think about the income tax. And then, of course, the income tax is highly politicized. Right. The sales tax is occasionally up for some debate in a given state. But, you know, it's not a highly charged issue where the federal income tax, of course, is a deeply partisan issue, as you can see in our debate just these last few weeks. So for these two reasons, because of the politicization of the income tax and because of the differential in terms of the difficulty of payment, people tend to discount when they're thinking about the taxes they pay. They tend to discount the sales tax, the payroll tax, gas taxes, and they tend to put a heavy weight in their mind on the federal income tax. And the result is that they miscalculate their, you know, how much they themselves are actually paying, but they also tend to discount payments made by other people, and especially by lower income Americans. And lower income Americans tend to do this too. You know, so frequently in interviews, I did surveys, but also interviews to really capture more completely how people think about taxation, in part because a lot of the typical survey questions tend to have a pretty strong class bias. They're focused on taxes paid by the rich, and not the taxes paid by most people. So in interviews, I was struck again and again by how often lower income people would say to me, oh, well, I don't know if you should really talk to me about taxes because I'm not really a taxpayer. But lower income Americans, the lowest income Americans, are paying something like, on average, 11% of their income just in state and local taxes. Never mind the payroll tax, right? And 11% of your income when you're making $20,000 a year is an enormous sacrifice, right? And so I think it's a real shame, frankly, that the $2,000 we take out of the income of someone who's making, say, something close to minimum wage doesn't get treated as a real commitment to the common good, when of course it is, right? Because when we think about what taxes are, they are the portion of our labor that we dedicate to the public good, and that is supposed to be allocated according to the democratic principle. And when we denigrate or ignore or erase the contributions of low-income people, it genuinely, I think in my research demonstrates substantially, reduces our sense of their right to participate.
Why do you think the notion that some people are, in essence, freeloaders is so politically explosive? Obviously, it also gets very racialized in an American context, but it can be also just about simply class.
Right. So I think that there is what is probably, frankly, a deeply, you know, embedded evolutionary trait to look out for who's not doing their part of the work. Right. One could easily imagine why that's an important thing to keep an eye on when you live in a small society and you know everyone else. And, you know, it's probably pretty deeply ingrained, I would think, to look out for who's shirking. Right. And which is, you know, sort of fine when you're trying to make sure that, you know, everyone's doing their fair share of hunting and gathering or what have you. But it becomes really problematic when it in a society that has very strong hierarchies and stereotypes about what hard work looks like and who is by nature hardworking. And so because we have these very long-held stereotypes in the United States, I think that, you know, that frankly probably kind of human instinct to keep an eye out for who's not doing their bit becomes a really very toxic inclination in society.
So you've talked about how it's one part of attitudes around taxation. focus on the idea that poor people, often poor people of color, are freeloaders. How about American attitudes toward those above them? Are they also seen as freeloaders?
So that was an interesting thing I found in my survey, right? So you're absolutely right that there's a fair amount of concern about lower income people not doing their part, a sort of invisibility of low income taxpayers. But if you ask people what bothers them most about taxes, right, about 14% of people say nothing in particular, which is already a little bit surprising. But the remaining people who can pick something that bothers them about taxes, the top two concerns are these. One, that corporations aren't paying their fair share. And two, that the wealthy aren't paying their fair share. Between the two of them, those are about three-fifths, let's say, of people's responses when you ask them what bothers them most. Something like 10% of people say the amount that they pay, right? So while the sort of image of the freeloader does tend to be sort of racialized and about low-income people, there's actually very, very widespread concern in the United States that wealthy people are not paying their fair share and that corporations are not paying their fair share. And this is actually something that I think is resonating in the tax debate in Washington right now, because if you ask Republicans whether they think the corporate tax rate should go up or down, most don't say it should go down. Most say it should either stay the same or go up, right? So, I think sometimes we forget that there is actually a pretty widely held consensus, first, that taxation should be progressive, and secondly, a very deeply held concern that rich people aren't chipping in enough.
Well, I guess this speaks to the point you made earlier that social policy is not being driven by public opinion, because presumably there would be much more outcry right now about the new tax policies on offer.
One of the challenges of getting there to be a substantial amount of outcry about tax policy is, at least traditionally, people tend to separate it in their mind from benefit cuts, right? Tax cuts and benefit cuts aren't seen as related. What's really remarkable about what's going on in D.C. right now is that the Republican Party is making that connection very, very clear, in part by putting part of their effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act in the tax bill, but more generally with the budget process, they've been very clear about wanting to cut very popular entitlements like Medicaid and Medicare. So maybe those connections will be clearer this year than usual. But yeah, I think in general, historically speaking, it's sometimes hard to get people motivated around tax issues because it doesn't feel like it will have the effects that it in fact does have, which is to put political pressure on elected officials to not invest in the social safety net.
What did you find in terms of the connection between attitudes towards taxation and attitudes toward government spending more broadly?
So there are basically two things that I found as sort of the connections between, broadly speaking, attitudes about taxation and attitudes about spending. One, when people underestimated the taxes paid by lower income people, they were more angry about spending on the poor, right? And that holds even if you take account of partisanship and ideology, right? How conservative or liberal you are, whether you're Republican or Democrat, even, and in fact, especially for conservative Republicans, the more you underestimated how much poor people pay, the angrier you tended to be about spending on low-income people. So that was one piece of it. The other piece of it is that when people were concerned about rich people and corporations not paying their fair share, that tended to ramify out into a broader sense of concern that the government operates on behalf of the very wealthy at the expense of everyone else. So you would see, for instance, a conversation about government waste, right? Quickly move from, you know, concerns about inefficiency to very broad concerns about special interests, about corporate power, about legislators living lives unlike average Americans. And so I think those are the two connections I really saw. One, underestimating tax paying by the poor and being very angry about spending on the poor. And two, recognizing some of the, you know, loopholes or concerns that or other ways in which corporations and wealthy people avoid paying taxes, and connecting that to a broader sense that democracy doesn't work for most Americans.
Say a bit more about the fear of government waste. Where do you see that anxiety as coming out of, and does it resonate more with people on the right than the left? How do you understand that?
There's a statistic that gets quoted from time to time. that Americans think about 50% of the federal budget is wasted. Right? It's a statistic you often hear in parallel with another statistic suggesting that Americans think 25% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid. Right? Both of these are terrible overestimates. And here's why. Americans actually have much more sensible ideas about the budget than those statistics would lead you to believe. In the case of government waste, when people talk about government waste, they're not just talking about inefficiency. They don't think that sort of on a regular basis, enormous bags of cash are falling off the truck, right? They're not thinking only of the overpriced hammer, although they do remember the overpriced hammer for sure. When they talk about waste, the first thing that most people refer to is entire programs they dislike. So on the left, that tends to be military spending or spending on wars, although there's actually some concern about that on the right in recent years. On the right, it tends to be concerned about spending on entitlements, right? It's entire programs that people think are wasteful, not in the sense of inefficient, but wrongheaded. So that's one category. The other way that people talk about waste is either to talk about sort of pork, as I refer to it in the book, which is, you know, sort of corporate spending for a particular military contractor, spending in your district that didn't really need to happen, the bridge to nowhere, those sorts of spending. And then another category, and that was a category that concerned people on the left more than the right, although many people are concerned about it, and there's a slight partisan differential. Another way people talk about waste, and this is something that I heard a little more on the right than the left, is that elected officials are living lives of luxury, right? So they would talk about fancy dinners. They would talk about members of Congress flying around the world on trips. Or they talk about, you know, one of my interviewees, I remember, talked about seeing the Christmas decorations at the White House, which seemed to him very luxurious. And, you know, this was, you know, a lower income guy living in Michigan. And he said, you know, I'm probably never going to see that. You know, he doesn't imagine, he was a young man too, actually, but he thought he was never going to go to Washington, D.C. and see any of that. Why were they spending his money that way? So this idea that people who serve in office are living lives that the rest of us really can't fully imagine because they are so luxurious. And so those concerns really are what people are trying to talk about when they estimate government waste. And when you think of all those different categories of spending, you know, very high numbers start to make more sense. Only about 10% of people in my surveys, when asked to describe government waste, described waste in the way that policymakers do. That is to say, inefficiency, a little bit of overpayment or duplicate services or too many bureaucrats or something along those lines, right? It really was a much broader and I think much deeper critique of the way that our government operates.
There's a broad perception that Americans are often very misinformed about politics and taxation is part of that. Would you say that that's accurate? And if so, does it apply to only particular areas?
Here's what I'd say. I think that we need to be clear-eyed about the fact that most Americans do not have a firm grasp of our tax system. But that's because most Americans are very busy and our tax system is very complicated, right? So I think that most people are operating without a strong base of knowledge is probably true, but that all too often, you know, in academia, in Washington, there's a tendency to shift from being sort of clear-eyed about the fact that this stuff's hard and it's not most people's job to understand it, and they're really quite busy with their jobs and families, to a kind of disdain for most Americans. And I think that's a real mistake. And I think that the right way to think about this question is, what can we do to make public policy visible for people who, frankly, do not have time to go poke around on government websites to find out what's happening to their money? What can we do to put more information at intersections that people have to go to anyway? So one example that I like is the fact that your sales tax is on your receipt. And people actually have quite good information about the sales tax. They tend to know approximately their local rate. Most people have, you know, something to add about how certain things are taxed at the store and certain things are not. People often have a sense that groceries are taxed differently. They have what is, frankly, a pretty good working knowledge of that. Where we get into trouble is when we start talking about taxes that most people don't have personal experience of, right? So the federal income tax to some extent, corporate taxes definitely, the estate tax. On those issues where they have no ballast, as I think of it, of personal experience to ground them, people are much more reliant on what they hear in the media. And unfortunately, a lot of the information you get in the media about taxation is bad and highly partisan.
So what sort of perceptions do people have about the estate tax, et cetera?
So the people tend to imagine that the estate tax applies to vastly more people than it does. It's something like 0.2% of estates are taxed. And even then, it's only above, you know, the first 11 million or whatever it is, if you're a couple, 11 million, if you're a single person, 5 million, is only after the first 11 million that it's taxed at all. So, you know, it's not really an unfair deal or what have you, but people do tend to imagine that that applies more broadly. Some good news on that subject, though, is if you give people better information, right? So the way they do this, they do a survey and then they randomly give some people more information about who this tax applies to, so that you can really see, like, scientifically how much that information matters. When you give people better information, they change their attitudes about the estate tax, and that effect is especially strong among low-income conservatives and Republicans, right? So information can change minds. The problem is most people don't have regular access to good information.
Talk about the flat tax in that context, how Americans see the flat tax.
Right. So most Americans think taxation should be progressive, and that holds up no matter how you ask about it. There's a tendency when asking this question, because it's an issue of great partisan dispute, to do surveys that get the answers that you want, right? So the joke is that questions about progressivity are used the way a drunk uses a lamppost for support rather than illumination. Right? So there's a little bit of a bias in the survey questions on one side and the other, but across survey wordings, Americans think that wealthy people should pay a higher, not just a higher amount, but a higher percentage. Right? That's what most people feel. Obviously, it's a stronger view among Democrats and liberals than Republicans, but most Americans feel that way. But there is about 30% of Americans who support a flat tax. What's interesting is about a fifth of that support comes from people who want to raise taxes on the rich. Now, of course, you could design a flat tax that would raise taxes on the rich. It would just be a very, very high tax. But typically, flat tax proposals lower taxes on the rich, right? And likely raise taxes on the poor. But the reason that people think the flat tax might raise taxes on the rich, and that's why they support it, is not blessedly usually due to total innumeracy, right? It comes from a concern about loopholes. And when people imagine a flat tax, they imagine a tax without loopholes. So even though they know that rates for the rich might go down, they think that there's so many loopholes that the rates don't really matter for the rich, right? So maybe if we do a flat tax with no loopholes, we'll actually get more money back from them. And that explains about a fifth of the support for a flat tax.
Right. So they think it just simplifies things and then everything will tick along better and be more equitable somehow.
Exactly. And I think it comes in part from a concern that is, you know, quite noble in some ways, right? People like to imagine equal sacrifice. And so many of my interviewees, you know, when you're thinking about a civic responsibility, you'd like to think that everyone can chip in. Right. And so many of my interviewees would say something like, well, I like the idea of equal taxation because we should all be paying taxes. But, you know, income inequality is so high that I guess we can't do that right now. Or they would say, you know, I support progressive taxation because rich people have just so much money right now. But if things were more equal in terms of income, then we could have a flatter tax and that would be fine. Right. So there's a sort of a commitment to a sort of civic equality that makes people want to imagine that a flat tax would work out fairly. And then they confront the inequality in our system and recognize that that tax wouldn't actually play out the way they'd like it to.
Let me end by asking you about the prospects for policies that have any kind of connection to the public attitudes that you've pointed to. I mean, you've said in the course of the hour that what you found in your surveys is that people, contrary to conventional wisdom, in the main do support paying taxes. They have uneasiness about thinking that other people may not be paying their taxes and not paying their fair share. But by and large, people believe that taxes should be paid and that people think those taxes should be progressive. is there just tremendous divergence between those attitudes and the kinds of policies that we're going to see anytime soon?
Well, I think that there's some very interesting movement on the left right now toward being a little more upfront about the fact that if you want to pay for big social policies, you've got to raise taxes, right? And I think that's something that you've begun to see discussed in a way that there was basically an omerta about this for decades. So that's, I think, a sort of promising avenue. Because at the end of the day, it's disrespectful to the American people to be dishonest with them about what it would require to put in place the policies they want, right? So I think that that's promising. But we face a political system, particularly at the federal level, where that was designed intentionally to prevent majoritarian rule in many circumstances, right? So we have a system in place where what most Americans want is not particularly directly linked to what most legislators want to do. And that, frankly, is a profound challenge for anyone who would like to see the policy preferences of most Americans implemented. And that, you know, plays out in a number of different ways. Of course, you see it with things like the Electoral College, but it also plays out in the Senate. It also plays out in the fact that Democrats tend to be crowded into districts where they win by huge percentages. And so that's sort of a waste of votes, right, when you do that. And so you get one representative instead of two or three. And so all of these things make it harder for mass mobilizations to change policy, right? But of course it can be done. But I think certainly in the very immediate term, I think that's pretty unlikely. But I think it is probably the question that's most important for this generation to determine, right, whether we're going to put in place systems that actually implement, at least with some regularity, the will of the majority of Americans.
Vanessa Williamson, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Vanessa Williamson. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. We've been discussing her book, Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. That's published by Princeton University Press. She's co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.